You are listening to the Cosmic Reality Radio Station, playing shows from the current week, in the hopes you'll take a listen, find something interesting, maybe informative, and maybe inspiring. Thank you for being here. Be safe. Is there something wrong?
Warning. Life support failure on all decks. Abandon ship.
Maybe it is time to take command.
Bridge to captain.
Join Jan Shaw and her guests as they discuss cosmic creating and the path to reclaiming our power as cosmic creators.
Library computer, data being received.
To go where too few have gone before. A production of Cosmic Reality Radio. And you're live.
Thank you, Nancy. And welcome to this week's Cosmic Creating Show. It's the 9th of February, 2019. Amazing how quickly the year is already passing. And I'm your host, Jan Shaw, the Success Alchemist. You can find me at thesuccessalchemist.net. And this week is no exception in having an inspirational and informational guest with me to share some wisdom and inspiration. And I have with me Reverend Alaric Hutchinson, who became known as the Zen Cowboy in Arizona during his 8-year span running Earth Spirit Center for Healing in the Phoenix metro area. Since 2010, he built the center from scratch, bringing together hundreds of people over the years and developing a spiritual community. Alaric's coaching practice grew along with his unique teaching style, which eventually was compiled into his first book, Living Peace, Essential Teachings for Enlightenment in the 21st Century. 2018 held a major life shift with marriage and a move. Today, Alaric and his husband, Andrew, now live in Bayfield, Colorado. So Alaric is actually a neighbor of mine. Together, they run the Zen Cowboy, which is a center for inner peace development that includes life coaching, Zen student training, and hosts a blossoming spiritual church community. So welcome, Alaric. It's really great to have you with me today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
Great. And I believe you like to do a little meditation to start things off.
Absolutely. This is how I ground every session, every Sunday, every class. And so let's go ahead and just take a deep breath in and letting go. We're going to simply honor that whatever happened during the day or during the week no longer exists. What's going to happen after this moment also does not exist. All that is right here now, here in this delicious moment as we breathe in peace. And exhale love, rooting, grounding ourselves with perfect love, trust, and awareness. We breathe that in, and we let it go, fully knowing that all is well, and all is well, and all manner of things are most deliciously well. Deep breath, and release. And so it is. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And here we are.
Thank you, Alaric. That was lovely. So I'd like to start in my usual fashion, which is really getting some history as to how you came to be doing what you're doing. And you're a pretty young man. You're a lot younger than me. So maybe the story isn't going to be as long, but I'm sure it'll be very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Ever since I was a kid, I had, I guess, a predisposition towards this work. As a child, I just always had this, I guess, instinctual knowing and this awareness. And I can remember really it started probably when I was 7 years old or 6 years old, and I just would look at life and it almost just felt like something was off in how people were behaving towards one another. And now I look back and I realize I was kind of an empath and just picking up everyone's stuff. And it definitely led to some interesting years that eventually turned into depression, clinical diagnosed depression for 6 years, social anxiety, and obsessive compulsion disorder. And so I actually had these tics while I was like 10 to 15, where I'd have to do things in sets of three because it was like a self-soothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd go to all the traditional route with a lot of therapy, and I was put on different antidepressants, and none of it was working. None of it was helping. Until finally, I was like 15 or 16, I started studying Buddhism and different world religions. And that's when I heard, like, you're the master of your life, and you can actually shift pretty much nearly almost anything. And so through meditation practice, within about 6 months, I got myself off all medication and cured myself of clinical depression, OCD, and social anxiety, all at the age of 16.
Wow.
And that's what really started this journey. And I realized the reason why I went through those rough years was, of course, there was a lot of issues with school and the bullying and being an empath. And like, I would always go to school and just be open up and be like, I love everyone. And I just get steamrolled. And then the next day, rinse and repeat. And my mom, she actually asked me something interesting. She's like, even when I was like maybe 14, 15 at the time, she's like, do you hold any anger towards these kids? And I said, no, they simply don't know what they're doing. Because if they understood the harm that they were causing, they would not be saying these things.
Mm.
And as a now a gay married, happily gay married man, back then, you know, obviously I was 12, 13, 14, constantly being called faggot, an abomination. I would be at school and they'd say, go kill yourself, things like that. And so it was a very difficult time. And that was even before I came out of the closet or even knew it. And so for me, at 16, that's when I really stepped into what some might say is your power, your confidence, your authentic truth. So I came out of the closet, started studying this, and literally just stopped being triggered by life, if you will. Stopped feeling that threat towards life.
Did you feel, when you were growing up, did you feel like you weren't fitting in?
Absolutely. And it's funny that I guess you could still say the same thing today, but because I'm a community creator now, it's kind of like nothing fit where I felt like it was in resonance. And so as an adult starting at age 20, I'm just like, screw it. I'm just going to start creating these communities for people because I would watch, you know, it's funny because at the time, you know, you would look up to like the Gandalf or the Dumbledore. And I was like, places like that, or the energy of the spiritual teachers, or my favorite was the Mists of Avalon and the priestesses. And I would look up to these fictional characters that held space on such a massive scale for spiritual awakening. And because I wasn't recognizing it or seeing it actually in the world, because I was, you know, a little country boy. And so I said, you know what, places like this deserve to exist. And that's what really started me on this path of creating these centers, these sanctuaries, these communities. And then of course, once I turn, you know, old enough, I'm like, oh, Thich Nhat Hanh, Pema Chodron. I really started resonating with Zen Buddhist monasteries and things like that.
Uh-huh.
So they do exist, and the Dalai Lama, for those of you who know. So I'm like, okay, I could start looking to real people who exist that have this peaceful influence on the world.
All right. It's interesting because so many light workers, when they're growing up, just don't feel like they're in the right place, probably the wrong planet.
Yeah.
I know I went through that myself. I found it very difficult at school, you know, didn't really resonate with the teaching or the other people. I found it difficult to make friends. I definitely see where you're coming from there.
Mm-hmm.
So I also like to ask people, you know, I've interviewed so many people with challenging upbringings, and ask if you recognize what the higher purpose of those experiences were.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I love that question. For me, I realized it was ultimately about compassion, because I recognize that I never want anyone to feel as I felt. You know, no child deserves to feel that way. Obviously, we can't always control what they're feeling from their family, but in school systems and from their peers, we absolutely can take a greater step in teaching about the ego and teaching about exactly where when kids are being mean to each other, or when teachers, in my case, a lot of teachers were aloof to it. You would go to them and they would just turn a blind eye.
Mm.
And so we can definitely start creating a society, and where no matter where you go, no matter what institution, especially educational institutions, it can be a safe space for learning. And unfortunately, especially here in America, and I'm sure all over the world, it's often not.
Same in the UK. I mean, the UK and the US are very similar in that respect. They both got fixated on testing and killing creativity and everything else. So interesting you were saying about being an empath, and so many of us are to different degrees.
Yeah.
I think there are advantages and disadvantages. Well, how have you experienced that?
For me, for the first 20 years of my life, it was very, very difficult. But ultimately I ended up going to college. Some of you may have heard of it, Southwest Institute of Healing Arts. I say it's kind of like the Hogwarts. So I got to go to Hogwarts and study all these cool different spiritualities, healing modalities, and then my degree was in psychology, transformational psychology. That's where I became a life coach, got ordained, do the whole Reiki polarity thing, and that's what started this journey, because right after I graduated, I opened my first business, Earth Spirit Center for Healing. But back to your question, once I opened my business, I realized being an empath allowed me to be a better coach. You know, really being able to see people, almost like I could feel people's aura and feel their vibration. And when they're speaking, I can sense what's in alignment and what's not in alignment. And so when they're saying these things, it almost allows me to go deeper into their subconscious root stuff. And so that's a lot of what people come to me for life coaching is they really love to get to the root of the issue early on. Because if you're in therapy, I always say if you're in therapy for 6 months to a year and you're still not at the root, I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Let's take a look at that. Normally within the first session or two, we find the root. And then from there, we start developing the peace practices. And I think as an empath, it allows me that greater ability to tap into and turn on. It probably has only been these past couple of years that I've really started to understanding how much healthy downtime I need to balance being kind of that. I'm an introvert extrovert where I can go out and public speak in front of hundreds of people, but at the same time, I need to balance that with plenty of downtime, because there are moments where it almost feels like you're about to have a panic attack to where so much energy is coming into you and you just can't handle a second more of any energy, even if it's happy energy. And that's what I realized. It's just it builds up, builds up, builds up. And so I'd say today I've definitely developed a consistent practice of being able to have that equilibrium.
I think that's a problem for many empaths, isn't it? I mean, I would say I'm an empath, but not to an extreme degree.
Yeah.
But there are many that really struggle to differentiate between their own feelings, their own energy, and the energy of people around them.
Yeah. And I help a lot of individuals with that. And a lot of it stems, you have to look to the mind, because depending on where your thoughts are going, you're either emphasizing the empathness or you're helping quell it. And I was actually just working with someone who really struggled with that. And I was asking her, you know, what was her daily behavior? And she would constantly be looking at other people and analyzing their lives. And so when you're looking at other people, even if you're just out in public and analyzing them, you're letting their energy into you uninvited. Well, you are inviting it, but you're unaware of it. So if you're out in public and constantly going into other people's energy and just maybe you're not being opinionated, maybe you're just having compassion, but you're still looking into them, because as empaths, it's really hard to turn that on and off. And so when I'm out in public, it's like a subconscious thing where it's just a flip switch and I turn that off. And if I look at someone, I just remain completely neutral. I don't develop a story, because as empaths or even psychics, intuitives, we can start to feel stuff. We might sense things. And I always like to say that unless it's in a sacred space in a session, it's none of our damn business. And so it's a great rule of thumb to just be able to look at life neutrally without developing a story about it. And when we do that, when you're out in public or in public settings or at a party, it really helps quell that energy so we don't feel drained.
I'm so glad you brought up the subject of being neutral and neutrality, because this has been my core foundation for all the work that I do with people. And I came across, I don't know if it was an intuitive thing or whatever, what I call the power of neutrality back in 2010 or 11. And it was an absolute life changer. It is just such a fundamental principle for consciousness, for self-awareness, for you know, self-mastery, really. And when you practice it, it just becomes your natural way of being. And it is the answer to judgment.
Yeah.
And I struggle with judgment for quite some time. And, you know, this is after I'd done quite a lot of work on myself. And I suddenly realized, oh, you know, this is all about judgment. And mm-hmm. And then I started judging myself for judging.
Yes, that's common.
But, you know, when we're on this journey, it's just like a spiral of upward raising of consciousness through just peeling off these layers and working on these different things. And I know people can get frustrated because they think, well, I've already dealt with this. Why is it coming up again? Mm-hmm. Do you find that a lot?
Absolutely. And with a lot of my clients and students, and it stems from, like, we may believe that we've dealt with something on a conscious level, but on a subconscious level, which is like our belief systems and those deep rooted memories that we have, it may not be fully released. In my book, I have the file exchange practice, which is the first tenet, mastery of thought, where I use an analogy as to where it's kind of like your subconscious mind is the library and the conscious mind is the door to the library. And every thought you think is being filed away in the cabinets and the shelves. And so a lot of times people hear like positive affirmations and you're really trying to not be a judgmental person. But what's funny is we may practice like loving thoughts, maybe 10% of the day or 40% of the day, even 60% of the day, but still 60%, and you have that 40%. And then guess what happens later on the week? You have a rough day or a rough few days and then the negativity comes back. And so we really have to be aware. And this is where the whole Zen and mindfulness comes in, you know, especially as spiritual seekers, we're constantly trying to, I don't like to say control, but I would say transcend or make friends with the ego. But a lot of times the instant we get stressed, then the thoughts go towards resistance. They go towards pushing the things we don't like. And so what I love about the file exchange in my book is that every single day, you know, we start with meditation so that we become very mindful of the thoughts that we're having throughout the rest of the day. And you might have to flip the script like 300 to 500 to 1,000 times, because think of how many thoughts we have during the day. And so that's where the whole judgment starts to come into it. And I see a lot of success with my students who may have read 100 self-help books in their lifetime. And they don't see much improvement because there's this lack of self-discipline.
Right, yes.
Or in that discipline where people don't always resonate with that because it has a negative stigma.
No, I find that is the absolute critical factor because, you know, a lot of spiritual seekers think, well, if I'm, you know, I'm being spiritual, then that will be the solution to everything. But you really have to work at it. And it's about forming new habits.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, once or twice. But it was, I was interested in what you're saying about the ego, because I was introduced to Eckhart Tolle's book,
yeah,
A New Earth, back in 2009. It was an absolute game changer for me because I understood why my second husband was the way he was. But in hindsight, the approach in that book was very much almost like the ego is the enemy.
Mm.
And when I started working with clients, it was really from the point of view of, you know, we've got to overcome the ego. And it was only several years later that, you know, through more learning and reading spiritual books and psychology books and so on, that I came to recognize that the ego has a purpose, and it's by valuing that purpose and making friends with it that you actually can master it, you know, because the ego is there to keep us safe. It's a very fear-based part of our mindset, and it serves a purpose in terms of physical threats. Mm-hmm. But as I say, you know, I love this quote, and I can't even remember where it came from. Danger is real, fear is a choice.
Yeah.
And I talk a lot about my experience with horses, and I've worked with a lot of horses with fear issues, particularly the one that I rehabilitated. And learning about the nature of fear is that fear is great for alerting you, but if you remain in fear, it paralyzes you. Whereas if you use it as as the signal to focus on outcome, mm-hmm. you can manifest the positive outcome mm-hmm. virtually, more or less every time. I know I've done that in the physical with horses about to flip out and explode. But by focusing on calmness and managing the energy within yourself and visualizing how you want the outcome to look, I've seen some incredible, well, I've experienced some incredible results.
I love that. And I like to look at fear going, bouncing on top of that. I like to view fear as just information. All negative emotion or feelings or stimulation, I don't view it as right or wrong, good or bad. I just view it as information. Mm-hmm. And when we can view it from that neutral vantage point, it absolutely allows us to tap into that greater growth, greater mindfulness, and then allows us to respond to the situation rather than react to the situation. And isn't that what it's all about? We're
Absolutely.
Responding or reacting, because when we're reacting, we're just kind of being in that perpetual creation of our same reality. But when we're responding, we're making step-by-step moments and choices to where we're shifting the direction of our life. And that's ultimately how I shifted away from the clinical depression to OCD, the social anxiety, because I recognized that 90% of it was just creations of the mind, you know, collapsing in on myself from these negative feelings, these negative emotions, and recognizing that I do have a choice. I could feel like shit, but I can choose to still be happy that day. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That polarity. I can feel on the inside, I can feel awful or I'm having a rough day, but I can still choose to be in gratitude. I can still choose to respond from a place of peace. A lot of people wait for their everything to feel at peace before they respond with peace. And I say, choose peace, and then the feeling will follow.
Well, that's really interesting, because it takes me back to my experience with my horse, actually, because and the thing I love about the power of neutrality is that it allows you to in Eckhart Tolle's words, to be the observer, and you're creating space between yourself and the situation. And in 2013, I was in Austin and I got a call. I had to, this particular horse, the audience will know because I've spoken about him many times, was delivered to me as a divine soulmate. Absolutely no question. He was a white horse as well, which is very significant. And he was my teacher. When I came over here, I had to leave him behind. And because of his very volatile nature still, even after rehabilitating him, I didn't want to let him go to anyone else that might not be able to interact with him in a way that wouldn't, you know, resurrect all his issues. So I left him in a boarding stable, and then I got a call in April 2013, which was just short of his birthday, to say that he was sick with colic and wasn't responding. And we created such an incredible bond in the work that we did together. And I had to make a decision to have him put to sleep. But in doing so, I was very aware of being grateful, of being able to handle this situation and make the right decision from that place of neutrality. And as I said before, I always look for the higher purpose in things, and it was some time before the answer came to me, I have to say, but I'd been really focused on manifesting him coming over here to be with me. Yet I knew in my heart of hearts that he wouldn't have handled or even survived that kind of journey from the UK all across the US, because there's only certain points of entry you can bring them in. And so I realized afterwards that the only way he could be with me was in spirit. And he is, and he's popped up on various, if I've interviewed a medium or a psychic, there's a white horse here. So he's still with me in spirit, and I'm just, but the point I was making is that ability to really be present and even have emotions without losing control of the situation, and really being able to, you know, manage all the information and come to a the right decision about the outcome.
Absolutely. And that's at the heart of everything that I teach in my book, Living Peace, Essential Teachings for Enlightenment. Because everything comes back to being able to be mindful, to be present, and to be neutral. Because when we get caught up, because here's the funny thing, a lot of people place emphasis over the mind, over the heart, or over the heart, over the mind. And the truth is it has to be a healthy balance. Because when we're caught up in our mind, we can get trapped in the fear and the overanalyzing, the judgment, the discriminating mind. But also in the heart, oh my gosh, you know, the wearing the heart on the sleeve, that, it's like we love the world so much, but we feel it so much on our shoulders. You know, it's going back to the empath. And so we can collapse with feeling, but we can also collapse from the overanalysis. And so being able to bring that together in harmony, being able to be mindful of all situations at all times, that is the self-mastery work that I teach. And not only me, but a lot of people teach it. Mm. And this is, you know, one of the prime focuses of Zen Buddhism, you know, being able to be the observer behind the ego, behind the personality, behind the identity, and say, okay, I recognize that in this human experience, I'm feeling dot, 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 I'm feeling this, but it's a temporary feeling, it's a temporary emotion, it's a temporary impulse or urge, and it will soon pass. But also recognizing that sometimes our urge is these things that we want, that we believe that will bring us pleasure or excitement. That pleasure or excitement will also pass. And so many of us get caught up in chasing after things, and we're not able to remain present in our current reality because we're so caught up in tomorrow.
Absolutely, yeah. It's I'll be happy when.
I'll be happy when.
Or if, yes, absolutely. And it's really about the present moment and what you make of it that is going to create whatever outcome that you want. It's interesting you said that about the balance, because having spent 24 years in corporate IT and, you know, I've been naturally a very left brain person, very analytical, very logical. And I actually did quite a number of personality profiles when I was in my corporate world in IT management. And interestingly, one of the things was balanced of introvert and extrovert, but also there was one that was focused on, are you more feminine energy or masculine energy? Which I was masculine energy, no surprise, because that's very much the left brain, logical, action oriented. But I went through a, you know, the dark night of the soul, like many of us do, during my second marriage, and was having, it just seemed like every possible emotional pressure from family and so on was just being, I was being bombarded with them.
Yeah.
And, I actually had a really interesting spiritual experience in my horse's stable, actually, when I was cleaning out. And it was like I heard a voice saying, it's time to move on. Mm-hmm. You've done everything you can do. And it was like, the flicking of a switch, in that my next steps, if I'd allowed logic to rule, I would never have taken them. But I had this overwhelming knowing that I had to just follow my intuition. It was almost like I had a pair of hands on my shoulder guiding me along the way. And that was when I started opening up more to the intuitive.
Yeah.
And, putting the intuition in charge and letting the logic work in hand with it.
Correct.
Rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite a life-changing experience,
totally.
I have to say.
Yeah. I would say that happened to me at some point as well. It was probably in my early 20s. I know I have a shorter span here.
I had to wait till my mid-50s for that. So.
But I was probably a few years into running Earth Spirit Center for Healing. And, you know, I opened that when I was 20 years old. And when you're 20 years old, you're still figuring your stuff out, of course. And I had really not so great boundaries. And so I wanted to be this, it was kind of like same thing when I was a teenager. I just wanted to love everyone. And so I had no healthy boundaries and people would constantly come in. And then there would always be some chaos. It was just, and I would ask myself every night, I'm like, okay, I'm just teaching peace. I'm just wanting to love people, but why is there still so much chaos? Why is there still so much disharmony? And, you know, all of it always comes back to projection and people's egos. And even if you're a spiritual person, you're still going to be triggered by people. And, you know, we're still learning how to get along. But eventually one day I just had that awakening moment of just listening to my intuition, because I would often override it because I wanted to be accepting. Mm. So accepting and just let anyone in no matter what. And eventually I just said, you know what? Okay, my inner circle are going to be individuals that I can tell anything to, and they're going to tell me anything to, and there's going to be no trigger involved. That's the foundation I'm setting, the intention I'm setting. None of this business to where I believe that just because I'm an accepting and compassionate person that I have to let everyone in for tea. We can meet outside for tea for a while, but it doesn't mean you have to come into the interfold of my inner world. And so today I'm so blessed. We're like, probably for the past couple of years, it's just been consistent inner peace, not only in my marriage, but in my close circle, in my leadership team. It is an incredible night and day difference when I started listening to that intuition rather than just overriding it just because we have this belief that just because we're spiritual, we're on this path, we have to be present for everyone at all times. And unfortunately, that just leads to burnout. That leads to the boundaries being crossed. That leads to giving constantly ourselves, but not having that equal energy exchange.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've been very fortunate. When I came over in 2010, it was the intention of organizing the Festival of Enlightenment, which we actually held in Estes Park in 2011. And I was really... my circle was wholly talking to people who were in that spiritual conscious community. And that's really continued ever since. And I think, you know, one of the things my horse taught me about was energy.
Yeah.
In fact, not just him, but every horse I've worked with has always had fear issues. It's, you know, I always say that manifestation of things in your life are very much connected to life purpose. And that's what I recognized with my passion for horses, because I learned so much from them. And even long before I was even aware of this spirituality, consciousness, whatever, conscious evolution, you know, I was always drawn to those high-spirited, sensitive horses.
Absolutely.
With issues. And I was unknowingly learning about how to focus on outcome, how to manage my own energy. So if a horse was afraid of something or worried about something, I would calm my energy down almost into a meditative state, and then I could raise it up again if there wasn't that kind of issue.
Yep.
And I think that taught me also to pick up on the energy of other people. And, you know, one of the things that I teach is there's a lot of information about body language communication, but very little about energetic communication and how we are subconsciously communicating through our aura, through our emotional state that is energetic based, and through our mindset. And I think we become so much more discerning rather than judgmental.
Correct.
As a result, as to who are the right people. Because, you know, a lot of spiritual people kind of want to awaken people, and they're trying to awaken people that are just not ready for it. And so reading those people in a neutral way is really giving them the respect that they are choosing their own path, and nobody can force them onto a different path or further along the path if
Absolutely.
They're not ready.
I love that. And I'm going to challenge the listeners with this comment. It's one of those things to where when we generally have inner peace, we don't even recognize if someone's awake or not awake. We don't even, that thought doesn't even cross our mind, because we're just present with life, and all life is beautiful, no matter how it's manifesting. And I think that's really important for us to hear, because a lot of us start this path because we get into this savior complex. We want to save the world.
Well, I did, I must say. I've learned and, from that.
And it's beautiful because it can help us get us on this path. But at the same time, when we're in that mindset, we're attached. And when it doesn't go the way we expect, we get disappointed or we get frustrated. And then it becomes conditional love rather than unconditional love. One of my biggest quotes from my book is, unconditional love is the outer expression of inner peace. If we don't have that inner peace, then our love is always going to somehow turn conditional, because the moment things don't go the way we expect or we want, we're going to get triggered. And when we're triggered, when we're in that emotional place of bias, we're not able to be fully unconditionally loving, because we're letting external situations influence our inner well-being. And that's what the Buddhist monks really teach us, to be able to be consistent no matter the external or internal stimulus. And so pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yes. And it's funny what you said about the savior complex. When I was interviewing speakers for the festival, one of the speakers I had was Panache Desai. I don't know if you're familiar with him. And I was talking to him. I spoke to every speaker because I wanted to make sure they're in alignment with the vision. Absolutely. And everything else. And he said, you know, you're not doing this for the world or saving the world. You're doing it for yourself. Unfortunately, I'd worked enough on my ego not to blow up and say, what do you mean I'm not doing it for the world? But it was interesting because it was absolutely true. And this is where I love to see the connection between life purpose and soul mission, because I believe that we go into doing things because they're the perfect environment for us to learn what we're here to learn and to fulfill that soul mission. Because I had to face up to so many core issues during that probably 9-month period. Mm-hmm. Fear about money, worthiness, all sorts of things, which I would never have done if I hadn't gone through that. And, you know, the festival was a divine mission I was given, and it was absolutely failure is not an option. Mm-hmm. And there were so many times I could have given up on it. And this is why I really stress the importance of people getting in touch with their passion and purpose, because that's the only way that you're going to work through the challenges that come, that are there as our teachers.
Absolutely, absolutely. Passion and purpose. Let me breathe into that for a moment. I want to see if I have something to share on that. Can I expand on that for a moment?
Be my guest.
Because I've worked with a lot of people over the years that don't know what their passion or purpose is, and I'm sure you have as well. And sometimes there's guilt that can manifest out of that, or shame. Mm-hmm. And so what I would like the listeners to really hear from this is, find that place of, what's the word I'm looking for? Being okay with the okayness of life, and that no matter what moment we're in, it's enough, because that's the miracle of life. Because so many people struggle so long and so hard trying to find their perfect purpose or their perfect passion. And a lot of times it can almost like be a self-criticizing journey until we find it. And so for anyone listening, you know, take this as a moment to recognize, rather than trying to jump straight into that or constantly chasing after that, recognize the okayness of this moment, and that right here, right now, it's enough.
Well, also right here, right now, it's perfect, because, you know, I've got a lot more years under my belt than you have.
Absolutely.
But when I look back at the path, every experience I've had, I call it an apprenticeship. So, you know, purpose changes or evolves really with in alignment with how we evolve. So, you know, I look back on my IT career, and you know, my passions really in that career were not technical per se. They were business focused and people focused, and it was recognizing how much I was invested in helping my team develop, because that helped, that actually ensured the success of the projects.
Yeah.
And I've always been focused on developing strategy and systems and processes that will support the business to achieve the business goals. So very much in that mindset. But it also being, you know, I was a business analyst, and very analytical. So when it came to discovering about manifestation of the law of attraction, I was really into what are all the factors that are involved in this and how does it work? And I wrote a book, Empowered Manifestation, which is on Amazon. And that's really bringing together a much more multidimensional view of it than just thinking positive and saying, I want a new house. I see it very much, as I said, in alignment with our purpose for being here. Because I don't know about you, but I have manifested so many things that I never consciously desired, but which have been so influential. I mean, Nancy, the producer and the founder of the radio station, there was so much synchronicity in us being brought together, and I hadn't a clue who Nancy was before I came across her. But lots of things have happened that I think come from our higher self that are guiding us on our path. You know, somebody will come along and say, read this book, and then they'll disappear out of my life, you know, just to give you these signals, which I find absolutely magical, actually. I think it's so much fun.
It makes life a bit more magical, doesn't it, when we can recognize this.
And so, you know, I can see the significance of all the experiences that I've had in life up until this point in making, in revealing my purpose, which is not finished, it's always evolving. Correct. And in, you know, I remember having thoughts of why on earth did I choose to do this instead of that, you know, because I was always passionate about animals. I wanted to be a vet, and then I ended up doing my degree in English, and I would think, why didn't I follow that, you know, biology or zoology or anything. But you know, now I love writing and I do blogs and I've got, you know, books and things. So it's really about acceptance and recognition of the significance of things.
Absolutely. And isn't that lovely to know? You know, I think especially as we age, we can always look back and recognize that, oh, okay, that's why I went through that experience. And I think that's important for all of us to remember that no matter what experience we're going through, there's always some delicious nugget that we're going to get from it, some wisdom that we're going to get from it. While we're going through it, it may not feel that way, but Abraham Hicks, one of my favorite quotes from her is, you'll never finish and you can never get it wrong. You'll never finish and you can never get it wrong. So isn't it wonderful? Isn't it a wonderful relief for us to hear when, even when it feels like we're not on our path, we're on our path.
Absolutely.
Even when it feels like we're not on our path, we're on our path. Oh my gosh. That is such a relief for a lot of people because again, I think more than judging others, we judge ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that is one of the most detrimental things, and we judge ourselves far more than we judge other people, actually. I love that, what you were saying about, you know, everything on your path is perfect. Not in those words, but that's the general gist. Because, early on in my coaching career, after that was started 2011, I think it was 2010, 2011. I came across the book by Dan Millman, The Life You Were Born to Live, which I've used with my clients a lot, and it's given them some real aha moments of insight. And for any listeners who aren't familiar with it, it's based on numerology.
Okay.
So it's based on your birth date. And I discovered that my life path was to deal with issues around abundance and power. And it was really interesting because I'd been working with clients and really looking at, you know, one of the ways I look at the source of their inner issues is through the early experiences that have created these false beliefs about themselves. And I was looking at it from the point of view almost as if they were victims of this and needed to recover from it. And then, in my usual analytical way, I realized looking back at my childhood experiences that I had been experiencing in the negative these very conditions, for want of a better word, that I was here to address and work through. And, you know, Dan Millman says you start working in it from the negative, and as you develop, you work into a positive manifestation. Mm-hmm. So when I look back at my early life, you know, plunged into lack and scarcity because my mother was left with three children, my father left and I never saw him again, and also multiple issues, particularly in school, of being totally disempowered by people in authority. And even I remember probably towards the end of my university course, so 2021, I suddenly had this realization that I was allowing a victim mentality about abandonment by my father to really dictate what I was doing. And I, as you were saying, you know, you are the architect of your existence, which is what the Cosmic Creating Show is all about. And I, by recognizing that, it was like, right, I'm not going to let this run my life anymore.
Amen to that.
Yeah. So this is why I always like to ask about higher purpose, particularly in people's early years, because so many have been through experiences that are part of their soul mission and also part of their life purpose in having that empathy to help people that have been through similar things.
Mm-hmm. Something that you mentioned about the negative creation, I love that because we're never not manifesting.
Mm.
And when we're unaware of things such as the law of attraction or the seven universal laws, we just create the same day again and again, the same type of experiences because we're unaware of it. Groundhog Day. I call it in my book, negative self-certainty. We're so certain of the negative qualities within ourselves or within the world or within others that's just what we keep replicating every single day. And when wake up to this awareness, then that becomes the choice. And we recognize that all of going back to the art of neutrality, everything is neutral in life. It is our egoic duality that we're projecting right, wrong, good, bad, what is better, what is less than, onto this human existence. Because I view it as completely neutral. When you look out on the world, even chaos is neutral because it's the ebb and flow of life. Even life, even death is a neutral thing. It's neither bad nor a failure. It's just a natural part of this existence. And when we can start to view everything from neutral, all of a sudden, boom, that place of peace. Now, more than ever, we can really start to activate that law of attraction. We can really become that architect of our creation, creating that reality. And so that's what I teach folks, especially people who've been involved in law of attraction for so long, but things just keep happening that they don't prefer. It's probably because they're trying to manifest from not a place of inner peace. They're trying to manifest from a place of grasping for or fear.
That's interesting. There's a couple of points I want to follow up on there.
Yeah.
The first one actually goes back to the Zen Buddhism, because I was attracted to that. Again, it was down to my horse. I was reading everything I could lay my hands on in terms of equine behavior and natural horsemanship. And I came across a book called The Tao of Equus.
Yes.
Linda Kernoff. And in the book, and that the book is about her emotional recovery through the way of the horse. And it starts to become pretty metaphysical.
Yeah.
And she talks about feeling haunted. And it turned out she was being haunted by horse ancestors.
Hmm.
And she originated from Eastern Europe, which is, again, the home of shamanism. And I started to feel this absolute compulsion to look into reincarnation. And that really started me on my spiritual path. And I've been very drawn to Buddhist. And actually, in my soul profile, I have very much a link to the Buddhist, but I've been interested in other teachings as well. But I was going to bring up this concept of manifestation again, and that it's not as simple as it seems.
Correct.
In relation to soul contracts, because, you know, I've got friends and I've had clients who have said, why am I manifesting these experiences? Why am I manifesting these people into my life? And I don't know if you've read the book, The Little Soul and the Sun, by Neil Donald Walsh, but it's a dialogue. It's a children's book, actually, and it's a dialogue between two little souls. And they're talking, one little soul says, and this is a very, very brief explanation, but I want to experience forgiveness. And this other little soul says, well, I'll help you. And the first soul says, well, why would you do that? And the second soul says, well, it's because I love you. And but goes on to say, but I want you to remember that when I do things, when we're in the physical life, that really hurt you, I'm doing it because I love you. Because, and I have this saying, how can you learn forgiveness if you've nothing to forgive? So this comes back to this concept of manifesting people into our life who are there to teach us something, and often in apparently negative ways. I mean, what's your view on that?
I love that. And I love to contemplate this type of stuff, but from my viewpoint as in Zen Buddhism and the Dunichi spirituality that we practice here, is we really don't go too much into the past life or the future or the next, because all speculation is limited due to our human consciousness. So that's my disclaimer. So let's dive in, though, because I can definitely have resonance and I can contemplate. And so it makes sense. It definitely makes sense. We can't know for sure, but it definitely makes sense that there is a soul contract that we may have with certain individuals that are here to help us grow. And I think that's a very helpful belief that we sometimes have, because it makes sense of maybe if we grew up in a very abusive childhood home and then later on in life we recognize, oh my goodness, this was such a soul-growing moment because I can now forgive this individual. And
help others going
and
through.
And help others go through it as well. And something that I love that I've heard too, where kind of like the whole idea of karma, which I believe more of karma as a law of attraction and action. But let's talk about more the traditional karma. When you're in this repeated pattern again and again and again with someone and they're abusing you, one of the most beautiful things you can do is take yourself out of the abuse, because now the abuser doesn't have someone to abuse in that moment. And so it's healing for both people. And that's great for codependents. Raise your hand if you're a codependent. How we keep ourselves in these situations because we believe we're here to help them. But sometimes the greatest help is removing ourselves from the situation so the abuse is not continuing to happen.
And so many people in abuse take responsibility and blame themselves.
They blame themselves. If I was only ... more, then maybe not, this would not have happened. But absolutely. But yeah, I've actually have heard that story before. And I love that story because it really does help heal people who've gone through incredible trauma. And then we can view it from a different lens. And when we can view it from a different lens, consciousness raises, vibration increases, and then the healing work can begin. Again, if we look at it from a completely Zen perspective, they might have a different outlook on it. But I believe these things are here to work together. They're all different pieces of the puzzle that make the whole.
Well, one of the things that I like to teach is this link between gratitude and forgiveness, because you've probably gathered I'm kind of obsessive about this higher purpose of everything. But, you know, if you actually look for that from neutrality, you know, I've been married 3 times. I don't really remember much about the first one. It didn't last that long. But I actually can see what the higher purpose and what benefits I've had from those relationships, even though they've given me the toughest challenges.
Yeah.
And so I can be grateful that I went through that, because for example, my second husband, it was almost like parallel, you know, the husband and the horse were both being catalysts for my shift, and it was a major shift. So I can see that. I mean, it was a very emotionally challenging period for me, the last probably 6 or 7 years, mm-hmm. for various reasons. But I can see that without those experiences, I wouldn't be here now. And it's the same with the third husband. I can see the value that I got from that in making me a much stronger and self-reliant person. And so that allows the forgiveness, because if you're grateful for something, it follows naturally. But if there's still resistance or resentment or blame or, you know, negative perspectives on it, then it makes forgiveness impossible in my view.
Yeah, absolutely. In my book, I teach, this is kind of fun, this might be fun for you, that there's no such thing as forgiveness. There's only acceptance. Mm. Because the moment you accept something, you no longer need to forgive it. And so I teach a lot of people, a lot of my clients and students, because you might spend your entire life trying to forgive, and it just doesn't work. And so in my book, I'd say acceptance, you'd say gratitude, and I think they work hand in hand. Mm. And so I love your example of saying when you have a grateful heart towards a past experience that maybe was very painful, the natural progression is forgiveness. Mm. Or I would shift that and say the natural progression is acceptance. And once you accept it, you're no longer thinking about it. You're just like, okay, I'm done. I let it go.
And I think there's also an element of taking responsibility as well,
absolutely.
Rather than being a victim of those circumstances and situations. Well, you know, I do believe that we choose the experiences that we're going to have. And that, to me, makes it much easier to accept, well, I chose to do this, so... You know, it's no wonder I'm getting all these challenges. It's not because I'm stupid or hopeless or just, you know, no, not good enough, which is one of the real fundamental issues. It's because I chose to do this and considered myself strong enough to go through it. Mm-hmm. So that, again, boosts that self-belief, self-worth.
Mm-hmm. And I think even for people who are not spiritual, and they may not believe they chose it on a soul level, because we can definitely speak to people who don't have that belief. We chose to get married. We chose to have that child. We chose to go into that job. Nearly everything that we've, especially once we're an adult, everything we have experienced through that, somewhere on our path, there was this belief that we wanted that. And then it turned into something we didn't want. How often does that happen where we really wanted something and then it turned into the exact opposite of what we expected? But still there's that responsibility of saying, I chose to be in this relationship. I saw the red flags from the beginning. Or I chose to go into this job. I saw the red flags, but I wanted the money. You know, dot, dot, dot. It could be anything.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, there are people that do things and say, I have no choice. The choice might be tough and it might be difficult, but there's always a choice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like follow the path less traveled, or, you know, are you choosing the easy way out because that seems to be a lot less painful, but is actually going to lead to more pain in the end? Or do you take the harder path and actually reap the rewards for that?
Absolutely. And I love that. I'm all about taking the the more challenging one, because I'm an advocate of saying show up even when it hurts.
Mm.
Because the main thing to look out for is the stagnancy. You know, when we just stop showing up, and that's when things really start to go south, I believe. Because even when life is painful or things are happening, when we show up, even when it hurts, especially in human interaction, that's when growth can occur. I tell folks, I tell everyone, if you have an issue, if you have, if I've triggered you in some way, tell me, because then we can grow from it. The worst thing that we can do, or rather the least beneficial thing we can do, is to just keep it all bottled up. because how many relationships fall apart because of that, when we're not able to be fully honest, radically honest with one another. And even if it hurts, it's going to lead to some awareness. Even if the relationship crumbles, there's still some awareness there, because guess what? That relationship is probably going to crumble anyway. So you might as well put all the information out on the table. And even if they don't grow from that moment, in the future there can be growth. A lot of people get stuck in their patterns because no one's willing to challenge them. No one's willing to leave. No one's willing to say, hey, this isn't peace. This isn't love.
And I think also what helps in those conversations, again, is going back to neutrality. Because having a shouting match screaming the face down does not help at all. The emotions have taken over. And unfortunately, so many of these soap operas and reality TVs
we crave that as a culture. We buy into it.
Well, it's encouraging it.
Yeah.
You know, this is normal behavior, and it's so disempowering. So being able to keep that distance and detachment from getting over emotional, defensive, aggressive, all the different things, is so much more constructive.
Absolutely.
Well, we're at the top of the hour.
Sounds good.
Being a great start to the conversation. When we come back, I'll let you share your contact information.
Okay.
And let's have a talk about your book.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So back over to you, Nancy, for a short break.
Hunter Hayes, Invisible, it's 4.5 minutes.
Crowded hallways are the loneliest places for outcasts and rebels, or anyone who just dares to be different. And you've been trying for so long to find out where your place is, but in their narrow minds there's no room for anyone who dares to do something different. Oh, but listen for a minute. Trust the one who's been where you are, wishing all it was sticks and stones. Those words cut deep, but they don't mean you're all alone. And you're not invisible. Hear me out. There's so much more to life than what you're invisible, all invisible. So your confidence is quiet, to them quiet looks like weakness, but you don't have to fight it, 'cause you're strong enough to win without a war. Every heart has a rhythm. Let yours beat out so loudly that everyone can hear it. Yeah, I promise you don't need to hide it anymore. Oh, and never be afraid of doing something different. It's dare to be something more. Just the one who's been where you are, wishing all with sticks and stones. Yeah, the words cut deep, but they don't mean you're all alone. And you're not invisible. Hear me out. There's so much more to this life than what you're feeling now. And someday you'll look back on all these days, and all this pain is gonna be invisible. because they don't understand. If you look past this moment, you'll see you've got a friend waving a flag for who you are and all you're gonna do. Yeah, so here's to you. And here's to anyone who's ever felt invisible. Yeah. And you're not invisible. Hear me out. There's so much more to life than what you're be invisible. It'll be invisible.
And you're back.
Thank you, Nancy. Lovely piece of music as always. And this is Jan Shaw, the Success Alchemist at thesuccessalchemist.net. And I have with me today Alaric Hutchinson, known as the Zen Cowboy, who's an author, life coach, Zen teacher, and pastor. So, Alaric, would you like to start with sharing your contact information for our listeners?
Oh, absolutely. And just the easiest way to get a hold of me is www.zencowboy.org. And if you and on social media, just look up Alaric Hutchinson. There's only one of me out there. And it's A-L-A-R-I-C. Yeah.
Excellent. So I'd really like to know how you came to have the name Zen Cowboy.
Absolutely. Well, it's I grew up in Queen Creek, Arizona, which right now, you know, years later, it's part of the Phoenix Metro, the whole Phoenix Valley. But back then it was just all farmland. And I was on 5 acres and I had like every poultry known to man, chickens, ducks, geese, turkeys. And then for a while we had horses and then we had neighbors that had horses and just every farm animal. So I really have this roots in nature. And years later, I recognized whenever I'd be out with the horses or the chickens or the goats, it's meditative. And so I recognize that cowboys in general and cowgirls, there's this natural down-to-earthness. There's this natural awareness, this mindfulness.
And groundedness.
And groundedness. You know, you're really connected to the earth. And to work with animals, especially horses, as you were saying, there has to be this connection. There's this intuitiveness. And so it naturally falls in with Zen. And even country living itself is more simple versus the fast pace of city living. And so moving out here, because at first it was Earth Spirit Center for Healing, and then I sold that business in 2018. Now we're here, and I started the Zen Cowboy business location. And I'm just like, okay, this is a perfect blend between, because we're in a small little country town, and introducing some Buddhist philosophy.
What made you choose Bayfield?
I've been coming here ever since, probably for the past 10 years. Every summer, my family would come to Vallecito Lake nearby. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is Colorado, especially this area, was mainly my biggest spiritual point because I'd always, for every summer as a teenager, I'd always bring like 20 like books on spirituality and philosophy, self-help. And so I would just dive in, you know, it'd be like a couple weeks of no technology. And so it just became this big root of mindfulness and spirituality for me. But ultimately, one day I want to create a monastery in the forest. So like a Zen retreat / monastery for Zen training. And in Arizona, although the desert has its own beauty, which I do love and I do miss it, there's something different about the forest. And when you're walking through the forest, there is a healing energy there. And there is just a slower pace life here. And I love smaller towns and that community feeling. And already we've been just accepted with warm and open arms here. So that's ultimately what led us to Bayfield.
Right. And I think the mountains have a lot of influence as well. When I was organizing the festival, one of the major criteria was that it had to be in nature.
Correct.
I just could not even entertain having it in a event center in the middle of the city. And, of course, we were near Denver. And Estes Park, of course, is right on the edge of the Rocky Mountain National Park and the mountains. And we had elk coming through. And it was – because I believe that this is one of the major issues in the world is the detachment of people from nature.
Correct. And that's what people don't realize. It's like they want to go in nature, but we are nature.
Mm.
We are a part of nature. And when we recognize that, we start to – rebalance ourselves and have that harmony. And when we separate ourselves from it, that's when a lot of dis-ease starts to cultivate more than ever. And then I wanted to say one more thing too. This, people may get a kick out of this, but I would always be dressed the nines in my cowboy get up because I was a semi-pro line dancer on a team for 2 years. And so two-stepping and line dancing, we would perform for charity events. And we've gone to Las Vegas before and San Francisco, performed in front of a couple thousand people. That was our largest event.
Cool.
And so it was very demanding and intense, but so much fun. And so for like half the week, I'd be full up in my cowboy get up and practicing and going places, part of a team. And so I'm actually going to be starting line dancing, beginner line dancing classes here.
Oh, really?
Here in Bayfield soon.
Maybe I'll have to take you up on that.
And so it's just a fun, you know, combining the mindfulness of Zen, but also line dancing, any form of dancing, learning steps, there is mindfulness in it. And it's healthy for the mind and body. It creates that mind-body connection.
Yeah, and you really have to be in the present moment. This is the thing, going back to the horse situation, you know, especially with a horse that is quite volatile, you have to be absolutely present at all times. And, I would pick up, you know, if there was some nervousness or anxiety building in the horse, I'd be, you know, rather than having to react or respond to it after the event where you're lying on the floor, you know, you're there to actually, and this is so indicative of life, isn't it? If you're very present, you can deal with everything that comes up in the most effective way.
Absolutely.
And have the perfect dance steps at the end of it.
Oh yeah, because there's been times when I'd be dancing or learning the steps and then you think of the future, you think of the past, instantly you miss a step.
Yes.
So you have to be fully in alignment with the present moment. So the Zen cowboy makes perfect sense. A lot of people question it, but I'm like, actually, when you look at country living, when you look at the cowboy energy with horses, when you look at the line dancing, again, it's kind of a stereotype, but it is true.
Yeah, I love it, actually.
There is a mindfulness in it. And I look, and this is just a side comment, I look pretty good in the cowboy hat, too.
Actually, I've got a cowboy hat that I got when I first came
over.
My ex always used to call me the English cowgirl.
I love it.
But interestingly, there's also a book that I saw when I was living in Evergreen, just outside Denver, a book called... I can't exactly remember. It was something like The Cowboy Philosophy about honor and honesty and all the virtues that make up kind of the cowboy way of life. So it's very appropriate in that respect too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us more about your center here in Bayfield.
Yeah, it's funny. So we moved here in June of 2018, and we finally just got to open in January of 2019. So it was quite the remodeling experience. We won't go into that. But the beautiful thing is January 6th, I believe it was a Sunday, we had our first church gathering here. Because I recognized here in town, there's really no spiritual hub. There's no, I mean, we have a beautiful crystal shop, but that's more for one-on-one. But there's not really a place where community can join together on a consistent, regular basis. And so probably in November or December, I had the awareness, oh, it's time to start another church, which I actually was a pastor between 2011 and 2013 at Earth Spirit Center for Healing when we had Earth Spirit Church. And that was a beautiful experience of about 50 members. And so here, we had our first gathering and we had about 20 people show up. And so it's funny how it's just whenever, and you kind of, you know, the authentic purpose, what's fascinating as it's over time as a life coach, I've really had to work for it. You know, I've always had great sessions and stuff, but the business aspect, there's always that climb that we're doing to develop business and marketing and stuff. But whenever it came to starting churches and communities, it was always like an instant thing. People were just there, and I was always shocked. And so I definitely feel that stepping back into the role of pastor and seeding a spiritual, quote, Zen church is definitely in alignment with the direction. Because I think a lot of people miss community. They may not resonate with traditional religion, and so they just throw away community altogether. And I believe that community is such a huge part of our ability to have consistent happiness, support, and that foundation. And we all have rituals that we go through, the rites of passage of life. Do you want a stranger doing that for you, like marrying you, burying you? Oh, all these things. Do you want a stranger having those ceremonies, or do you want someone that you're close to and really knows your life story? And I've been blessed as a pastor, as a reverend, to be in that role for a lot of people and be present for those rites of passage. I've married couples, and then I've blessed their first child, and I've even had the I don't want to say opportunity, but the honor to have, you know, a death ceremony. And those are really important in our culture. So long story short, here at the Zen Cowboy, I'm really creating an atmosphere that will eventually lead into the Dunasha Monastery that we hope to cultivate, because my husband and I are considered modern monks. So we're not fully monks, but we take a lot of the vows and we're very present. We have the robes. And I have a lot of people in Arizona that I train that also wear the robes. And so we're really hoping to create a place where people can not just go once a week or once a month for healing, but live at. You know, maybe they want to come for a month, 3 months, 6 months for a retreat or a short time living. Because if you really want to have a life makeover, it's important to be in an environment that fosters it 24/7.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is a challenge for many people, I think, that they kind of get into a spiritual mode and environment for a short period of time, maybe once a week. And then they kind of slip back into the not mindfulness.
Correct.
And not conscious way of being.
And that's what I've learned over the years having Earth Spirit Center. It's always funny. I'm like, okay, everyone, who meditated this week? You know, that was your homework. And then maybe like two people out of 30. Because it's like you go, you feel great. Or maybe you read a book, you love it. But then instantly you put it down, you leave, and you go back to your grind. You go back to the daily grind. And it's especially difficult for maybe individuals and families that are not participating in the same teachings. But again, that could be an opportunity for greater growth, because I always say, let the world trigger you, because if it's your triggers that are going to show you where there's still work to be done. But ultimately, especially my husband and I, Andrew, I mean, we live such a peaceful existence. Even through the whole remodeling phase that we went through and the issues with, you know, costing 30% more than we realized, not one fight, not one argument, not one disagreement. You know, we try and do embody these teachings full time. And so we can't wait until one day that we're able to invite more people into a community type living, even if it's only for a month. Because when you're in this setting, you can have whatever issues you have, but then when you're in a setting of peace, you're going to feel it so much more versus trying to work on your peace in a setting that is in constant conflict, constant stress. And our culture certainly doesn't really help with that, because our culture still is primarily ego-based. It's always about getting more, being better, being the best.
Being right,
other people being wrong. And so there's that constant polarizing energy.
And also the technology, it's like it keeps people on the go all the time. I mean, I know I love technology, so I'm probably the worst offender when it comes to it. But, you know, it's so much part of what I do in my work.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I enjoy that. But there's almost become this addiction, hasn't there, to
there is
constant contact, but virtual contact, not in-person contact.
Not in-person. And I view that more as a distraction, you know. More than ever, more than any time on our planet, we're at a time where we can be virtually distracted at all times. If we don't want to deal with something, we can check out. and we can just log on to social media and start looking at someone else's life or reading some information. And on one hand, this is so valuable because it connects people across the world. And I think that's really valuable to have in an important time on our planet to really build bridges. But at the same time, I actually did a month cleanse off all social media in November. And my goodness, my mindfulness went through the roof. I was so much more calm, especially as empaths. Every time you're scrolling social media or constantly searching the web or reading new things, it's a perpetual stimulation and there's no quiet. You may be in a quiet atmosphere, but on the inside, you're not quiet because you're constantly being stimulated by new information.
I feel it like an energy drain, actually.
Absolutely. Yeah. It definitely is.
And I know I've had this conversation with previous guests about the impact of social media on people, where they're seeing people who seem to be having so much more perfect lives than they are. And it's almost like, if only I was like that person, and really comparing themselves negatively to other people, thinking they're living this wonderful life. And I always say, you know, somebody might look like they've got it all off perfect, but believe me, they have issues that they're working with as well. You know,
and that is the truth, because I could attest from so many clients I've worked with, you know, they let me into their hearts and their minds and their homes. And it is funny because you'll see the difference in what they post and to what they're actually going through. Mm. And I would say the vast majority of what we're posting, you know, on social media is not the ultimate truth. It's just a sliver of our experience. And so I let people know that if you're seeing someone with success or seeing someone with happiness or maybe the body type that you want, it could be whatever is your egoic grasp.
Yeah.
Find gratitude for them and say, wow, I'm so happy for them, because it shifts your mindset from comparing to just being grateful for them and sending them love, because the truth is they can probably use it just as much as you can.
Yeah, and a lot of the advertising on social media, particularly Facebook, is so much, you know, how many ads do you see about, you know, I was penniless and broke and maxed out on debt, and then I discovered this way of doing something, and now I'm making millions and all the rest of it. I mean, that doesn't help people either.
No, and I was just having that thought like 2 days ago, because I was scrolling through Facebook the other day, and I'm like, 10 of those ads popped up. And probably because of my life coaching career, you know, and so I'm just like, oh my gosh, it's just like every 5 posts, there's like this thing. And I'm like, okay, I want a new message. And I'm going to start teaching people. Not everyone has to be a millionaire. Mm. Not everyone even needs to make 6 digits. We can live simply and that's enough. And we can have a happy existence doing that. And I really, really want to help people understand that no matter what our circumstances are, so many of us are blessed because our needs are met. Even if we are living paycheck to paycheck, we still have a pretty nice life. You know, we're safe. In most cases, most of us are safe. And most of us may have some happy connection, at least one in our life. And yeah, our job might be tough, but at the same time, if we shift our mindset around it, we can decrease our stress by 50%, because we definitely add to it based off our negative thoughts. And we do have a lot of freedom here. Mm. And so I really am trying lately, a new message of mine is helping people appreciate what they do have versus that constant, constant perpetual striving for more that just leads to a lot more anxiety, stress, and self-criticism.
Absolutely. And I mean, I've lived a fairly minimalist life since I came over here because, you know, it's quite a funny story that my third husband tells about. I came downstairs one day. This is when we decided that we were going to come to the States and do the festival. And I had a lady that would come into the house, and she'd do. I was actually running an eBay business at the time, Equestrian Media. It was called, one of my passions. And I came downstairs and I said, put everything on eBay. We're going to America. And literally cleared out. I mean, the things that I had were kind of my half share of my second marriage, where we had a 5-bedroom house and everything else. And so we sold a lot of stuff. We gave a load of stuff to charity, and I ended up leaving multiple boxes in my daughter's garage. And then, it's probably a year later, after we'd been over here for some time, she got in touch and said, "Mum, this is a real pain to have all this stuff." So I said, "Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll have a Skype session and we'll go through and decide what we need to keep and what we don't." And would you believe, at the end of all of that, I got one cardboard box.
Wow.
That's about the size of a wine case.
Yeah.
With just things that were really special photos and books that I wanted to keep. And, I feel as though even though I've been here for 3 years and I was in Austin for 4 years, I've still had this feeling of being a nomad and not attached to any particular place or possession.
What a gift.
Possession. I know.
Because there is beauty in that. And I definitely think there's this huge movement of minimalism that's happening, throughout the world. And when Andrew and I, we moved here, we were stuck in about four months of extreme renovations, to where we had almost a dirt floor, pretty much. Not fully dirt, but the whole carpet was ripped up and it was just really rough. And we didn't have a bath or a shower. We didn't have a kitchen because we were transforming a commercial place into a live and work space. And so for about 3 to 4 months, we were without 99% of our belongings. We didn't have a bed. We weren't able to fully bathe except raccoon baths in the sink. And we weren't able to cook food. And we didn't even have a floor. And we were still happy. We still made it work and we're at peace. And that's what really helped me understand how little the physical circumstances of our life matter and how much more the internal matter. And the Zen Buddhists teach that, or any form of Buddhist teaches that, or even the Catholic monks that really take vows of poverty, make vows of chastity, all these different vows where you don't need to have a lot to be at peace and to be happy. And that's really what I've been trying to bring more to people's lives here at the Zen Cowboy and in my book, Living Peace.
Yeah, and it is all about perception, isn't it? And how do you define enough?
Yeah.
That is about perception.
Absolutely.
And how do you define wealth?
Yeah.
Again, that's perception. And, people tend to immediately think in terms of financial wealth, but there are so many other things like community, as you were saying before. And going back to what you were saying about, we always have enough. I mean, one of the ways that I got through these scarcity issues to, belief in lack and so on, into much more of an abundant mindset, was through having so many experiences that proved that it would always come through. And in fact, one of the stories I love was when I was in Austin after the festival. The festival was an absolutely phenomenal success in terms of experience. It was a financial disaster.
Okay.
So literally came out of it with nothing. Ended up down in Austin. This is a very short version of the story. But we got to the point, the universe conspired for us to be without money, without food, without anything. And it was all due to funds that I get through from the UK all getting lost in the banking system and so on. We'd even sold our vehicle to keep us going. And it was an interesting experience, because when I'd finally sorted out the UK bank issues, I then discovered that there was a US bank issue and it disappeared into the ether over here. So I'm ranting and raving in the morning thinking, why is this, what's going on? Why is this happening? And then I did that switch into solution mode. Right. Yeah. What do I need to do to sort it out? So I phoned the bank, and apparently they'd closed the bank account because of lack of activity and an overdraft, and said, "Well, if you come to the bank, we'll open a new account, and then that money can be deposited into the new account, and it'll settle the small overdraft." It was minimal. So having no vehicle, we had to walk to the bank, and it was like a 3-mile walk each way. So I set off with ex-husband number three, to walk to the bank, and I set out with the intention I was going to find some money.
Mm-hmm.
This is it. I'm going to find money. So I'm walking along, and we get to this big grocery store, supermarket, as I'd call it, which was just across the road from the bank. And I look down to the ground, and there's a dollar bill lying there. And I'm thinking, wow, a dollar bill. I found cents and nickels and dimes. I never found a bill because usually they blow away, aren't they?
Yeah.
So when I picked it up, I was in my gratitude mode, which is indicative because I wasn't saying, well, a dollar's not going to do me much good, is it? It was very much, wow, I've got a dollar. And I set the intention I was going to get $50. So I went into the bank, got the bank account set up, and they said, the money won't land for 3 days. So I immediately think, that's okay. Everything's going to be fine. The solution will appear. So as we were walking back from the bank and got to an intersection with a Wells Fargo on one corner, and I looked down and there's a $50 bill lying on the ground.
Love it.
Yep. And I'm thinking, this is not a coincidence. Mm-hmm. And it was right in front of Natural Grocers where we used to do our shopping. So we got food for the dogs and everything. But, you know, if I ever have that little doubt about money, I always go back to that because it tells me that I can manifest and I'm looked after. And there have been so many examples of that.
Oh,
and I think
if,
the more we can anchor that belief in and recognize that we are taken care of, the more of that we get.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that powerful?
Yeah.
Let's take a moment to breathe that in because that's a powerful story. Thank you for sharing. Because that is so big. That's so huge. Because how many of us know the law of attraction, right? We've heard of it. But then we forget. And then we get into despair. We get into fear. We get into doubt. And we forget that when we're in alignment, when we're aligned with that source energy, if we want to call it that, it is fascinating how things can progress, how we can direct our focus, and our thoughts do create reality. You know, we're lining up with things. And there's been so many examples. My story is I manifested a potato. I'm like 18. I first started learning about it. I'm like, okay, show me a potato. And then one day, didn't tell anyone, a random raw potato was next to my, next to the tire where I parked at school. Just this raw potato next to my tire. And I'm like, what? And what are the chances of that? And so it cracks me up when we fall into our negative self-certainty after we've had so many successes and wins with the law of attraction. And it's really important for us to just shift that focus because thoughts and words are magic. You know, we're either creating blessings or we're creating what I use this word loosely, but curses, where we're sending out these like negative intentions unknowingly. So pretty cool.
Yeah, I have so many stories of manifestation from that period of doing the festival. Really interesting. I won't go into them now because I don't want to distract us too much. What I'd like to go back to, and it is related to manifestation and the law of attraction, is the Buddhist principle of not having desire.
Yeah.
Because that really confused me when I first read it. I thought, well, we're supposed to desire in order to manifest. So how does this work? So I've kind of reconciled that, but I'd love to hear your view on it.
Yeah, this is a question I get quite often. You know, how do I balance Zen with law of attraction? And the truth is, it's fascinating. So kind of back to what I said, you know, near the beginning of this talk, we're always manifesting. You know, because thoughts create things, it's our focus, and we're just, life is always unfolding before us. And we're either aware of it or we're not aware of it. So how I reconcile this is with when you have inner peace, you really don't desire much anymore, but you're still creating. And so I'm not really, compared to my young self that wanted to go out and save the world and do all these big things, and I'm still doing big things, but it's not coming from a place of egoic attachment. I'm okay if it doesn't happen. I'm just going to show up no matter what, because today I place my vow of peace, I place my vow of kindness, I place my vow of community and connection and acceptance. So however that's going to manifest each day, which it manifests as a center, a community, life coaching, the Zen training, my book. And so it's not, let me back up, let me take a breath, because I have a short story I can share with this. So when we moved here, and I was creating some programs, and it was a very difficult 6 months because I sold the business. And then when you move, you know, people don't always want to do long distance. So all of a sudden I'm living paycheck to paycheck for the first time in my life. All before we had a great savings and I had a lot of income coming in from the old center, but here paycheck to paycheck. And I'm still producing the same work, but it was hell trying to get clients, probably because I myself was still in that like uprooted position. And I found myself creating content and it not selling or people not signing up. And I found myself getting frustrated. I'm like, what the hell? Does no one want peace anymore? And that was a big ego moment for me. It didn't last long. But what I recognized is I was attached to it. I was desiring money. And then I finally let it go. And I said, okay, I'm just going to sink into this moment. I'm going to let go of my desires. And I'm just going to be peace and still keep producing work, still keep showing up. And eventually things are going to shift because everything is temporary. Everything is transitory. And sure enough, starting this January, it was like the pendulum swung and I'm coming at all of my creations from a place of inner peace rather than expectation and excitement, because the opposite of expectation and excitement is disappointment when it doesn't go as planned. And that drops us back into negative vibration, drops us back into the creation of things that we don't desire. And so it's this fine line that we must really walk of really practicing our peace and continuing to show up, but not coming at it from a place of all these expectations that lead to disappointments later on. Because you're never not going to stop doing your work. You're never not going to stop showing up and having relationships because life is always unfolding.
Yeah. And the way I kind of interpreted it, I think that explanation is brilliant. The way I saw it is that desire is often then focused on the lack of what you want. And that is
absolutely
that. Then, of course, you're through the law of manifestation, you're then manifesting continuing lack. And that was the thing that really clicked with me. So
isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
And I think that's a big I don't want to say mistake because that adds to that duality, but that's a big missing the mark, if you will. We're shooting that arrow and it's flying, you know, the opposite direction.
It's almost like a boomerang.
It
comes
it's a boomerang
back and hits us,
and
doesn't
it hits us and it hurts. And a lot of times, a lot of our desires do stem from feeling like we don't have enough. And so if we look at the subconscious root of why we have this desire, is it truly coming from a place of inspiration and peace? Or is it coming from a place of fear?
And it's also because we don't have enough, we're not enough.
And then it becomes a reflection of who we are, what we are, our personality. And then, of course, we go back into Zen where in my book, The Ninth Tenet, Release Self. You know, we have these nine tenets we work through on mastering and understanding ourselves, our thoughts, impulses, emotions. But then the ninth one is release your identity. And if you release your identity for the first time in your life, you can be that selfless servant to humanity. Because if you're trying to help the world or even help yourself from that place of ego, you're probably going to get muddy. You're going to get your muddy hands on things because it's going to be biased and prejudiced, often coming from a place of negative emotion rather than that genuine acceptance.
It's funny you should raise identity because I went through a real identity crisis.
Lovely.
Last year. It was so funny. And in fact, it was to do with my name change. You know, when I got the divorce, I decided to revert back to my maiden name. And I still, I even slipped when I was introducing myself for this show a little bit. You know, it still hasn't got completely embedded. But it was interesting because I was very undecided about, I knew I wanted to change my name, release the energy of the relationship. And I was looking at numerology and all sorts of things. And then because I needed to make the decision for the divorce papers, I thought, oh, well, I'll just go with my maiden name, sure. Which it came through on the decree. I didn't do anything about it to begin with. And then one Sunday I thought, no, I've got to start going through. I've got, you know, books in the old name. I've got lead magnets in the old name, you know, websites in the old name. Spent the whole day going through this and changing to short for more. And the next morning I woke up a complete emotional mess. And I went through this whole thing of, I haven't been sure for 40 years.
Wow.
And I'm such a different person from who I was then. And it was really interesting because there was a post on Facebook from a friend, and it was saying, if you feel you're losing your identity, you know, we get these messages, don't we? If you feel you're losing your identity, it's not you're losing your identity, you're moving into your true identity. Mm. And, of course, I was letting go of all the connections, you know, of being in relationships, and for the first time for 40 years, I'm living on my own and very happy with that. And feeling strong enough to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was really interesting that it was me coming to terms with a different, it was like a rite of passage, a different phase of life.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm completely at peace with it. So
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think people forget, or we're not aware that these moments are rites of passage when there are those name shifts or after marriages, or, you know, just, or even just transitioning into different stages of life. There's so many rites of passages. And a lot of times it is a death of our previous identity, a death of a personality. And I think it's important to recognize that it's okay. You know, it's okay. We don't have to remain the same. And a lot of times the people around us might struggle with accepting this new identity, this new version of ourselves, because it's almost like their existence becomes threatened because they were so used to their friend or their mom or their, you know, sibling being one way, when in actuality, it's now time to grow and evolve into this new being. And it's okay.
Yeah, people become attached to
who they think you are.
Their perception of that person, don't they? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In Don Miguel Ruiz, I think it's the fifth agreement. I love the four agreements. I can never remember them all. I always remember three and not the fourth. But the fifth agreement, I think it was that there was a story about having a member of family in different cinema studios and watching the same movie about this person.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone had a different interpretation of that person.
Correct.
Based on their movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this again comes down to this whole thing about perception, doesn't it? And the principle of neutrality, that everything is meaningless until we choose our own interpretation, and why somebody thinks one person is, you know, wonderful and the other person sees them as the devil incarnate or whatever, you know. We have those differences in how we see things.
I love that, you know, the perception. And I actually say that, I teach this a lot, that there are as many Alaric Hutchinsons in the world as there are people observing me. And all of them have a different perception of me, and all of them are accurate to some extent, and it's okay. And they're accurate to themselves, you know? And so that's why if anyone's a people pleaser, it doesn't work. It will never work, because their perception of you is always more based on their own consciousness and vibration and their own biased experiences. And I also go on to say that there are as many realities on Earth as there are people alive, co-creating with it. And so we often view life through our own lens, and we forget that every single person has their own unique lens. And that's why, like, all these cookie cutter schemes that people come up with, you know, it could be politically, it could be religiously, it could be culturally, it could be anything, any type of cookie cutter. It doesn't always work, and it can't work, because so many people have different perceptions of reality. And that's why I always just come back to peace. I always come back to kindness. I always come back to acceptance, and just really try to make that the foundation, because peace is one thing that's universal and that can benefit, you know, anyone's life, because it helps balance that inner conflict that we have within ourselves that leads to unwellness.
And of course, it's the inner peace that leads to the outer peace.
Absolutely.
So we haven't got a lot of time left, Alaric, so I'd really like you to tell our listeners a bit more about the book that you've written, because that has only recently been published, hasn't it?
So this is actually the second edition. The first edition of Living Peace was published in 2014, and that's after me teaching for about 5 years, and I started seeing just themes starting to manifest and recognizing where people were succeeding, where people were having difficulties, and I'm like, okay, let me just sit down one day. And I went into meditation and I asked, what am I meant to teach? And within about a minute, the Living Peace Code came through. And that became the foundation. 9 teachings, 9 tenets that I started teaching all my students, all my clients. And boy, howdy, have we had a lot of success with them. And so this past year, after our experience of moving here, it really helped me fully come to know the 9th tenet, which is release self, going through our interesting experience of remodeling. And so I'm like, you know what? It's been 5 more years, and I think it's time to really rewrite this. And so I updated some practices, changed the format of the book, but the 9 tenets remain the same. And I also added a wonderful introduction on ego, because that's a big thing that's often miscommunicated or misunderstood. And so I'll just go through the 9 tenets real quick, just briefly. And so the first one is mastery of thought. Of course, thought is a building block of all reality. You know, you can't really succeed in the other 8 tenets until we fully recognize that we are the observer behind our mind. So that has a practice that really helps cultivate that. Then we have mastery of impulse that builds on top of mastery of thought, understanding that it's important for us to respond to life rather than react towards life. And then we have mastery of emotion. You're not getting caught up in the emotional tides or our feelings. So when you combine mastery of thought, impulse, emotion, all of a sudden, you develop this fantastic foundation of self-mastery that you're really aware of what the heck's going on inside. The next 3 tenets are more about how we observe life. And so we have ignorance is an illusion. We seek understanding. And we say ignorance is an illusion, meaning that it's a willful state if we choose to close our mind off to people. And so if we remain open, then information is going to come when it's needed to come. We can never know everything at all times. But if we're open, the information will come. Therefore, we're always seeking understanding. And then the second one is chaos is an illusion. We seek harmony. Really always trying to find the harmony and the balance between all conflicting sides of things, but also not observing life as chaos, because that is a judgment. Even forest fires have their purpose. Even hurricanes, they're not bad, they're neutral. We just happen to build in front of them. And so when we're viewing things as chaotic, even man-made things, human-made things, it creates disharmony within ourselves and it creates a lot of judgment. So instead we seek to be the harmonizing aspect. And then finally we have duality is an illusion. We seek transcendence. And the duality is the right, wrong, good, bad. I differentiate it between polarity, which is simply like nighttime, daytime, hot, cold. That's polarity. There's so much polarity in life. But duality is a human-made concept where we get our morals wrapped up into it. And a lot of times when we do that, it generally justifies our judgment for other people and justifies our own judgment towards ourselves. So we seek to transcend that. And instead of saying something's right or wrong, we simply say, does this lead to peace or does this lead to greater conflict? See how much more neutral that is? And then finally, the final 3 teachings is all about letting shit go. So the 7th is releasing our attachment to the mundane world, which we get into gratitude and minimalism, recognizing that these attachments we have towards outer life are all temporary and they can't bring lasting satisfaction. Then we have the 8th tenet, which is release knowing, which, you know, maybe up to these first 7 tenets, we feel like we start to know something. We get a little prideful. We're like, hey, I'm awake and you're not. You need to listen. No, we release our knowing because every single day is a new day. And what we learned yesterday doesn't exist until we reactivate it today. So we always maintain a beginner's mind. And finally, that leads into the 9th tenet, which is release self. which if we can practice all 9 tenets together, or the first 8, we can really start to relinquish this identity. Because when you don't have an identity, then you're able to be more present and aware for other people. So like for me, I really try to be the bridge between all politics, all religion, all cultures, rather than just saying, I am this one thing and this is my opinion. I release that so that I can be more present in conversations for all other people and help through their needs rather than what my opinion of their needs are. Ooh, isn't that powerful? Help through their needs rather than my opinion of what their needs are. And that is very profound, because a lot of people on the planet try to help through their own biased perception of what the world needs rather than fully asking what everyone's individual needs are. And so combined, these are the 9 tenets and practices that make up the Zen Cowboy, that make up our Church of Dunisha, that make up the Zen Student Training Program, and ultimately helps us become modern monks that really choose to live a life of service for other individuals, because all of our needs are met. We're not constantly grasping for more. Today is enough, and so we can finally and fully be present for others.
That's beautiful. Thank I love you. It. And, you know, it's, I don't approach it from the same position that you do, but a lot of the underlying principles are so close to.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I've said on numerous occasions, I am not a fan of guru worship, mm-hmm. where, you know, all the power is given to that one person. I mean, in everything that I've done, you know, like with my horse, when I was researching everything, I'd pick out the things from the different writers that resonated, and I'd just let go of the rest. Mm-hmm. And the same with the spiritual. You know, there are some people that only little nuggets in there will resonate, and the rest doesn't feel right. And I think this is so important that nobody knows it all.
Correct.
And, you know, it's about really developing that discernment in terms of intuition, and not the logic. Well, you know, he's so famous and he's made so much money, so he must be right. You know, that to me is really important, and using that in the present moment.
Yeah, it's a healthy balance. And so before we move on to the next thing, I'll just reiterate for people, because it's kind of confusing. So the name of the book is Living Peace, Essential Teachings for Enlightenment in the 21st Century. If you go on Amazon and you type in my name, Alaric Hutchinson, make sure that you point out the Essential Teachings for Enlightenment in the 21st Century, because that lets you know that it's the second edition.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just do you have a link to it on your website?
It is on my website. On my website, you can actually buy a signed copy, and I will ship it to you. I'll personalize the message. So you can find it on Amazon, on my website, and then for
people. And just repeat your website again.
Oh, yeah. It's www.zencowboy.org.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And you were implying earlier that you can work with people remotely. They don't have to be local.
Now, it's funny because, like, at the start of this year, now everyone wants to work. It's so funny because while I was going through the modeling, again, I guess I was just meant to be present for that. But, yeah, I do a lot of long-distance sessions, and we have our own video chat room. And it's really convenient and it's really fun. And so people can do live coaching long-distance anywhere in the world. And then also they can sign up for my Zen training program as well if they want to really dive into the teaching specifically.
So do you want to explain a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So just briefly, life coaching is just anything you want to focus on individually. You might be going through some tough times. But if you kind of have a semblance of balance in your life, but you just want to, you're ready for that next juicy bit. That's where the Zen training comes into it. And that's right now I have Healing with Your Chakras, which is kind of my own combination. And what we do is each month we go through a different chakra psychological archetype. So the first month we combine the root chakra with mastery of thought, which is the first tenet of living peace. Mm-hmm. So we work on the fear and the trust issues of the root chakra. And then we work on the thought is the building block of reality with the mastery of thought. And so I have journaling questions that really tap into the subconscious mind. I have various little homework tidbits. So you not only have a lot of homework, you have not a lot, but it's definitely enough to be ample, because let me back up. So we have homework, and then we have the teachings, and then you have private coaching around it. Because I've noticed over the years, when we just jump into a session and people don't always have like these journal questions, we don't go as deep as we could. If you had questions in advance, that then unlocks your subconscious mind and allows us to really get to the juice. And so each month progresses. It's a 7-month program. And then for people who want to go even deeper, I then have the Dunusha training program after that. And that's for people who eventually want ordination as a modern monk and minister, because as we speak, we're setting up the nonprofit for the Church of Dunusha.
Okay, great. And what's the meaning of Dunusha?
Dunusha is the peace and healing way of earth and spirit. So it combines a lot of the Zen philosophy of the Living Peace Code with a lot of earthen rituals and celebrations. And so we really honor the earth, and we honor the solstices, the equinox, and we honor that there is this energy, there's this underlying energy of nature, and that we're a part of it. And so Dunusha is the spirituality that I teach, while Living Peace is the philosophy that I teach.
Sounds wonderful, I must say. So we haven't got a lot of time left, but I just want to go back to just a little light-hearted approach to mindfulness, because what I like to say is what we're actually doing is creating mindlessness.
I like that.
Because, you know, so many people suffer from, you know, these, what they call monkey mind, but, you know, really their thoughts are just racing and racing and racing. And what I found, you know, I've been working on this for years, and as you say, it takes persistence and self-discipline to do it, and real presence of being aware of your thoughts. But what I found now is that I'm empty-headed. You know, we so use empty-headed as a derogatory remark, but I can, even as we're talking now, I can almost feel the space. And I also used to joke about ironing is the new meditation, and mucking out is the new meditation. And it's so many things that we do, we can turn into a meditative moment, can't we?
Absolutely. Our ordinary life is our spiritual life. There's no separation. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the example of when you wash the dishes, only wash the dishes. Because if you're washing the dishes and you're thinking of all these other things, you're not actually fully alive in that moment. You're not experiencing the full moment. So every single moment of every single day can be used as a mindfulness and meditation practice. And that's simply cultivating full presence of what you're doing rather than thinking of the past, a present stressor or worry, or some future anxiety or anticipation. And so I like the mindlessness of it because you're fully tapped in, tuned in, turned on to the present moment, and there's no added agenda to it. There's no added monologue to it, dialogue to it. There's no added story to it. And I think that's really profound. And that's ultimately what starts to occur the more you practice these teachings.
Yes. And I, I certified as a life coach and executive coach. And one of the teachings was about the nature of happiness.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten the name of the institute, but there is something online where, again, I can't remember it. But anyway, that doesn't matter. Senior moment. But what it's saying is that the keys to happiness are being in the flow, being totally absorbed. And as you said earlier about the line dancing,
yeah,
it becomes pretty obvious if you're not in that state of presence and focus. And even Eckhart Tolle in A New Earth talks about how the quality of what you're delivering in that moment is so much increased because your whole attention is focused on it rather than thinking about the next job you've got to do or what you did the day before or what's coming up next. And I think that when people get, sure, you can get into that. I know if I'm working on, you know, doing a website design or if I'm writing or doing things like that, it's something that is absolutely focusing all your attention, but you can do it on just everyday things, mm-hmm, you know, on the washing up, on the ironing and so on.
Yeah, and that's the goal, to do it in everyday things, because it's the everyday moments of your life that creates your life. It's not the big moments. And I think people sometimes forget that they focus so much on the big moments that they forget that it's the everyday little things that we do that create happiness, that create peace, or lead to stress. And the truth is, most people's everyday little moments are stressful because they're not present for the moments. They're always thinking of the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, or feeling about the guilt of the thing before, the guilt of the thing before, or the shame that we're holding on to.
That's right. And I don't hate to do it, but I'm going to use another horse analogy.
Sure.
Because when I was rehabilitating my horse, he had no self-confidence at all. So everything that he did that was a step, even the smallest step in the right direction, I had to praise and celebrate to build his self-confidence. And it became very apparent to me. I was very into dressage because Andalusians, as he was, I should say, you know, absolutely a dream when it's like riding cream. It's so smooth. I mean, it's incredible. So I was very into dressage, but you know, I was at a boarding stable in the UK and I would see people going into the arena and they would have a session and at the end of it, they would come out so frustrated, grumpy. The horse was pissed off because what they tried to do was make this great leap in advancement that was way beyond their capability and the capability of the horse. And I always say, you know, if you look at the universe, the power is at the quantum level. It's at the smallest step. And yet people just want to make these big leaps and don't recognize or actually carry out the small steps that need to be taken. And that was another lesson from my horse, that the more you celebrate the smallest advance, that is going to add up and add up and add up. And if it didn't work, then it would be neutral. It wouldn't be, it wouldn't be punishing or reprimanding or anything. It would be neutral and then take the responsibility of trying again, perhaps in a different way of approaching it. So, yeah. Oh, we're at the top of the hour. Imagine that. Okay. So I've so enjoyed this conversation, Alaric. I'm so happy that we've been able to do it face to face as absolutely. Which I don't always manage to do. So do you want to just quickly share your website again and then I'll wind up?
Yes, and thank you so much. It's www.zencowboy.org. And thank you again. I love being here today. And blessings.
Thank you. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. And it's Jan Shaw signing off, The Success Alchemist. You can find me at thesuccessalchemist.net. And as always, a big thanks to Nancy for producing. And I hope you'll be with me for a great show next week.
Awesome. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to The Cosmic Creating Radio Show with Jan Shaw, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio.
Live long and prosper.